Boom, we're on. And today's guest, we've got Jamie Hull. How are you, brother?
How you doing?
Yeah, good to see you, man.
Good to be here, yeah.
Mate, what a story. First of all, we'll touch on the book.
It's Life on a Thread.
Life on a Thread.
Yeah, Life on a Thread, How My Fight for Survival Made Me Stronger.
Powerful book, Life on a Thread. Very powerful book. It's a plane crash survivor. Like, your plane was going down, you ended up going on to the wing and then jumping off before it hit the ground. Unbelievable.
I got lucky with that, James, to be honest. It was a bit of quick thinking, quick action, but I was certainly up against it and under a great deal of duress, you know, fire in the cockpit that had breached at altitude as well. So I was able to just sort of think on my feet, come up with a plan, if you like, based on the training. So I'd received a bit of training, you know, with the US instructors beforehand for about 3 weeks or so. And I just kind of fell back on the emergency protocol, and I was able to make a decision to sort of switch everything off on following the dashboard or the instrument panel. So I switched everything off from left to right. So everything sort of off, off, off. And then remove the headset, unbuckle the harness, very low level, sort of gliding in, so descending, 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 gliding in, scrubbed off as much airspeed as I could get away with. And then, as I say, low level, open that left-hand canopy door, climb up onto the seat, momentarily get onto the wing and sort of balance and compose myself, look at the horizon. And then when the moment was sort of bang on, just right, so I was about, estimated about 15 feet, sort of standing on that left wing momentarily and probably running in at about 30 knots at the time, so about 32, 33 miles per hour, 15 feet above the ground. I looked at the horizon, I just went for it. So I just jumped out off the back, the trailing edge of the left wing, snapped my feet and knees together in the air, hands above my head, and sort of threw that little bit of airspace and then hit the ground. And it was, you know, like I hit the ground like a sack of spuds, to be fair. Yeah. It was a big impact.
Man, that your story is like, that's not defeated you though. The 60% burns, like in hospital for years, just going through all this stuff. So, and that's the powerful thing about your story. It's like, you've not let it defeat you. You've not just lay there and fucking give up. Like, you're now here. Now you do your runs, you're swimming, like, you're leaving. This is for anybody watching. This is the gold tier. These kind of interviews, that as long as you're still breathing, you've got something to give. But I want to get to know Jamie, who you are before the crash, what triggered you, what you went through, well, how was your life then, obviously what you're doing now. But let's go right back to the start, brother, where you grew up, how it all began.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think it's important probably to start by saying, you know, perhaps you know, an incredible story. You know, I came through all that. But probably the reason being fundamentally is because I was always a fighter. I kind of knew that. I was always a bit of a scrapper. Not necessarily in the physical sense, sort of argy-bargy down the pub. That wasn't really me, you know, sort of this threatening guy. But I was always a fighter in life. I was always trying to fight to kind of get on in life and try to make a better sense of life from my younger years. I kind of started out with a slightly sort of disadvantaged upbringing. I mean, it's not a sob story, and I by no means had a sort of a dodgy sort of upbringing or anything like that. But all it was that I, you know, in my younger years, in my youth, much of my parents weren't getting on. It was pretty evident that they were going to sort of separate at some stage, and they did when I was quite young. So I was about 12 when that happened. And for any kid that, you know, where the family unit sort of breaks down and, you know, the kids are sort of then perhaps pushed and pulled and perhaps spread to the winds, as it were, you know, parents separate. So my sister went with my mother, you know, my mother moved away. My younger brother and I stayed with my father. My father was busy working, you know, so he was long distance, you know, haulier, you know, driving these big rigs up and down the country and getting on with it. And so I was this young lad, and I became a bit of a tearaway for no other reason other than the fact that I was a young kid, largely unsupervised. You know, dad was away at work, mum was away, obviously, because parents had separated. And there's me, you know, kind of the elder brother, but I was only 12 myself. My brother was 10. And, you know, I stayed with my father because I wanted the continuity in school, you know, to stay with sort of my peer group, my mates. But I was largely unsupervised. So, you know, what happens to a young kid when they're unsupervised? They basically get up to no good because they've got that freedom and they've got that flexibility and no one there to sort of crack the whip. You with me? So that was the you know, the essence of my younger years. There I was kind of just kind of getting on with it, but not necessarily at first following the righteous sort of, you know, the proper path. So I was up to no good, bit of a tearaway. I was out late in the evenings and I was kind of like playing truant a bit at school. I was kind of getting involved in sort of a bit of criminal kind of fraternity. Not so, we're not talking major league, but nevertheless, I was up to no good, sort of up to all hours. I was kind of pilfering and like stealing from shops and, you know, out sort of breaking into a couple of establishments here and there. And just generally a bit of a pain in the arse for as a young lad in society. You know, a bit of criminal damage, bit of theft. Some of it sort of escalated and it was a little bit more serious, but I certainly wasn't, you know, like I said, it wasn't major league, but I was definitely following a slippery path in life. And then there was a bit of a turning point in my youth. So I kind of realised that in order to kind of get on and to avoid being kind of caught up with the law, because I got nicked a couple of times by the police when I was quite a young lad, for like misdemeanours, you know, pretty sort of petty sort of incidents. As I said, it might have been theft or criminal damage. So I got collared a couple of times by PC Plod when I was that young tearaway, that young kid, sort of 12, 13, 14 years of age. Mm-hmm. And I guess I started to reflect on being basically a young hoodlum, really. And I'm starting to think about it all in my mind. I'm starting to reflect. And I'm starting to think, well, you know, you got two choices. You can either keep up this pretense of being a bit of a hoodlum, you know, bit of a cock for all intents and purposes, you know, a young lad not towing the party line, getting into trouble clearly because, you know, you're getting nicked a couple of times. And perhaps if you keep going down this path, it's not going to be cautions next time around. You know, you're probably going to go to court. You're probably going to end up with a criminal record that's going to probably haunt you and follow you for, you know, young adulthood and perhaps rest of days. So I kind of got wind and I did sort of heed, you know, the warnings from the police at the time, you know, having got a couple of cautions. And I didn't want to be that, you know, that kind of ne'er-do-well in life that was following that slippery path and perhaps, you know, literally ending up in the slammer, you know, ending up in jail. So, you know, a bit of crime, there was a bit of drugs, bit of sort of alcohol indulgence, you know, at a young age. And before I finally realised, having learnt a couple of valuable lessons, like I said, getting on the wrong side of the law, that if I don't turn it around, no one else is going to turn it around for me. Remember, I was largely unsupervised as a kid, and it's not a sob story. It's just the way things were in the family. And that was like in the early 80s, so, you know, there wasn't really an issue with it. You know, let's say parents were away or out working and spread and sort of separated, and it was up to me. This is what I'm trying to say. It was up to me to turn things around, realise the errors of my ways as a youngster, turn it around for the better, like sort of take the high road and sort of, you know, steer away from the low road, as it were, follow a more righteous path and just try and crack on and be a better human being as a kid, sort of, you know, growing through adolescence and trying to grow up. So luckily for me, that's what I did. I sort of recognised it all, recognise where I was at and where I was kind of potentially heading. And I decided to spin it around and I tried to do better. So I remember getting my GCSE results and they were pretty shocking. I think I got like one sort of GCSE pass, like the old O-level, you know, perhaps. So like what I'm talking about is like a C and above grade at GCSE. So I think I got like one pass in like English, you know, literature or something. I quite enjoyed books and I quite enjoyed reading, and I got that one pass, and everything else was an abject fail. Got like E's and F's, or, you know, like completely failed. And I was like reflecting on it, thinking, my God, it's like, you know, I've pretty much done, you know, like 10 plus years of schooling here, and this is all I've got to show for it, you know. And I said I'd been on the wrong side of the law a couple of times, and I think only I can turn it around, only I can do better. So I actually went back, repeated my education for that kind of sort of final or secondary GCSE year. I repeated all that, did one day a week at college to do some other input at the local college in Dunstable, it was, in Bedfordshire. And I repeated that secondary year of GCSE in my high school in Leighton Buzzard in Bedfordshire, that was. And then I got a load more grades. So I end up picking up about, I think for the record, I got about 7 GCSEs, you know, like the old O-level passes the following year. And that was just about good enough for me to go on and do some A-levels. And I'm not joking, but a couple of years, you know, not even that, you know, like a year or so preceding, when I said I was getting up to no good and, you know, literally out till all hours and just being a general pain in the arse. So I would have never have foreseen that I could have sort of turned it around and gone on to do sort of some A-levels. Now, I think that was probably the start of the turning point for me, because I realised that if I was able to go on and do A-levels and potentially get a few grades there, then that could open up some doors, right? So we're talking, you know, possible job opportunities, you know, possible sort of higher education. And so that was the road that I ended up taking, but later on. So I ended up going on doing, I did like 3 A-levels, got a few sort of, you know, average grades, nothing to really write home about, but it was enough to kind of give me the opportunity in life. And I did consider higher education, but I kind of put that on the back burner.
Why?
I initially considered a career with the armed forces, because I was quite driven by, you know, sports in school. I enjoyed, you know, kind of football, rugby, athletics, a bit of cricket in the summertime, but I was a lousy batsman. And I wasn't much, you know, I wasn't really a natural academic, I wouldn't suggest, and I wasn't necessarily motivated in that arena. So I thought about, you know, the challenge, the adventure, and where was I going to get that? And the idea, I think, talking to someone in school about possible careers, the idea of the armed forces cropped up. And I very, very nearly joined the Marines. So I went through the, like, the initial kind of, you know, reviews and interviews for all of that. And I got an opportunity to start the ball rolling with the Royal Marines down at Limpstone. But I was able to put things on ice for a little bit of time. And the reason I did that, the reason I sort of put things on hold, because I made a decision that I wanted to go travelling. And this was something, I guess, born from, you know, perhaps a slightly unsettled youth. And I'd done a few jobs, you know, on the side, as you do, you know, just for earning a few pennies here and there. Saved up a few quid. And when I got enough money together, I went off travelling. And that was the first thing I did sort of after school, if you will. You know, once I got myself together, generated some money through some local jobs, I got this round the world ticket, and then I was off. And I went to, this was the absolute making of me as a young man, really, the truth be told. It wasn't really the education that I described. So I had the courage to go off travelling, and I did that on my own. And I went to South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Zambia, crossed the Angolan border even, went up into Malawi. I did all this on my own and left home, as it were, sort of still while I was 19 years of age.
Was that an easy decision?
Not really. I mean, it was tough at first, but I felt that, you know, something I wanted to try and get out of my system. And I had this pull. I'm not sure where that came from, but I've always been, you know, kind of a keen traveller and almost a little bit nomadic sort of in the blood. I wanted to get out there in the world, see the world, sample the world for what it can offer you. You know, the countries, the spectacular kind of beauty of it all, fact that, you know, different environments cultures, change.
All the cultures.
Absolutely, the culture, the people, and, you know, and going to see a bit of desert and, you know, sort of tropical locations, environments and...
Were you feeling lonely at that time?
I don't know about lonely, but I just had this pull. I wanted to
search for something.
You know, maybe slightly misspent youth, and I'd done a few jobs, and I'd sort of done a bit of education in the end, but not really excelled as such. But it was a form of self-education, if you like, and this kind of pull that I had to get out there and really see a bit of the world and do something really independent for myself before, you know, the likelihood was that I was going to come back to conventional, normal life, because I knew that was inevitable, you know, come back, whatever, settle down, you know, follow the sort of more conventional path. And I was just trying to put that off and see where the road would take me. But, you know, the traveling was fantastic, and really that opened up my eyes. And being on your own was actually quite a positive thing for me. So I met a lot of people.
In what way?
Well, I met some great people. So interestingly, when I was down in South Africa, and I'm down in, initially in Johannesburg, long story, but I ended up hitchhiking, you know, literally on the roads. I took about 7 different lifts from, you know, big rig sort of truck drivers to, you know, big sort of business guys with their BMWs or whatever, driving down that major highway between Johannesburg and Cape Town. And I'm hitchhiking to get all the way because I'm on a limited budget, right? I'm a backpacker and I'm trying to preserve the pennies for the long run, knowing that my goal was to be on the road for a year, because I had that back pocket round the world ticket. So, you know, the goal was there because the travel tickets were there, and I had limited money. I needed to try and preserve that. So where I could, you know, I'd try and do things, you know, beans and rice, so to speak, you know, keep things kind of cheap and simple. If I could save on a bit of public transport or another flight or whatever in country, I would. But, you know, the obvious thing to do was try and hitchhike. It wasn't necessarily the smartest thing to do, according to the locals. I can remember being in Johannesburg, and I'm walking around in the district in Joburg, and this was in 1995, and there I was, a young whippersnapper. And I'm literally walking around, and I could see all these people sort of clocking me, some of the locals, you know. And I probably stood out because I'm a white man in Johannesburg, a young guy, for all intents and purposes, kind of just cutting around the city. So all these people sort of clocking me on the street, you know, some of them looked a bit sort of dodgy. And I'm having to sort of think on my feet a little bit, and the last thing I wanted to do was get caught up and get mugged or something like that. So I'm trying to be sort of street savvy. And I can distinctly remember, you know, like these big sort of black Beamers and Mercedes kind of screaming down the road, literally. And then the horns would be like, meh, meh, meh. And then guys would wave at me. And I'm thinking, what are they hooting at? What are they waving at? And then I realized it was a sort of almost like a mark of respect from some of the, perhaps the Joburg sort of business set that would drive in and out from the suburbs. And they see me, you know, just a young white guy on the street in Johannesburg sort of strutting around. And that wasn't what people did. I was always a bit sort of, you know, perhaps risk averse. And I was willing to sort of push the boundaries a little bit. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there was a young lad in Joburg, and people said to me, oh, you don't want to walk out there, you don't want to go on your own, and you definitely don't want to sort of, you know, take too many risks here, you know, because it is a bit dodgy. A lot of people said that to me, even when I rocked up at the airport, you know. So there's me sort of pushing the boundaries, just getting a real feel for the place on the ground. And I had really, really very little life experience, but I was kind of just trying to use my instinct, really, and that was what was kind of driving me along. So anyway, I hitchhiked all the way down to Cape Town. And I wanted to see Cape Town. I'd heard it was spectacular, it was beautiful. You've got Table Mountain, you've got that big backdrop, and it's one of the most stunning cities in the world. Anyway, I got down there, and I mean, long story short, when I was down in Cape Town, I went off on some trips and I ventured around some different areas in South Africa. Ended up going back to Cape Town because I loved it. I thought it was a really picturesque, beautiful city. People were really friendly, and the backpackers and so on. So I went back to Cape Town because it was kind of like my favourite location down there. And there was a guy that was running up to the north, and he took this, it was a beaten up old VW camper van. And from memory, this guy was American. I think he was from California. And he kind of put the word out in the backpacker in Cape Town and said, I'm driving up north. I'm going to go up the N1, November 1, the road, which goes from South Africa all the way up to Namibia. Anyone want to come? And there was me sort of sipping, you know, this little castle beer or whatever it was in the backpackers in Cape Town. And I'm taking it all in. And I knew this guy. I'd been talking to him briefly. And I said, you know what, mate, I'll come with you. I said, you know, what's the score? I said, you know, what's it going to cost us kind of thing? He said, well, he said, I'm not going to ask for much. He said, just chip in for a little bit of fuel. We'll all club together. And we said, we'll get up there and we'll have a bit of a road trip. And there I was, you know, joining this small gaggle of folk in the camper van. So we drove up through the dead of night to avoid a lot of the traffic, driving out of sort of Cape Town and sort of wider South Africa, head up towards the Namibian border. And that was us up into the desert in the middle of the night. So I was doing quite ballsy things, you know, courageous things. I was quite brave at a young age. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily a boast, but like I said earlier...
Do you think that was with you then, Jamie? Do you think, again, that's with the mum and dad splitting up, kind of a wee bit of abandonment issue, just looking to search for something on your travels?
Yeah, I think I was just interested in really, like I said, perhaps a bit of a misspent youth. Perhaps I felt that youth had sort of let me down a bit. It's no sob story by any means, but I just wanted to really, now that I was independent and I was a young man and I was venturing out into the world, you know, for the first time, as it were, I really wanted to try and make the most of that. And I wanted to try and grab life by the horns and just live life and to really experience life. And the way that I did it, I felt, you know, looking back, I mean, that was what, 25 years ago now, you know, 26 years ago. So the way that I did that and the way that I experienced that, there was probably no better sort of education for a young guy that's really trying to initially make something of himself and find himself, as it were. So for me, that was a real education. You know, you talk about university of life. That to me was like the ultimate, you know, get out there in the world on your own, go to some of these weird and wonderful locations and countries, some of which were a little bit hostile, might I add. And, you know, get to meet the people, meet the culture, you know, befriend people, but use your judgment and stay savvy. You know, that was an eye-opener. That was a real education in itself. And I got a lot out of that. I really did.
What places were hostile?
What was that?
What places were hostile?
Well, so certainly, you know, I felt that, you know, bits and pieces of South Africa were hostile. Anyone that's been down there will know what I mean. It's not sort of, you know, necessarily on the face of it hostile, but, you know, it's not like there's an abject war zone going on, but there is a definite divide between, you know, blacks and whites. And unfortunately, there's the racial tensions and the racial issues. And I sort of felt that and sensed that when I was down there. You know, some of the local guys, some of the Afrikaans would sort of tell me stories, and you hear about stuff on the grapevine. And there was an incident when, I mean, this is a story in itself, but I'll keep this bit sort of brief. But I end up getting a job later on. I end up traveling in the north, met a gentleman up there that was a director of a business, gave me an opportunity to work for his business. And he had he had markets down in places like Durban, Joburg and Cape Town. He said, if you want a job, you know, long story short, I'll give you a job. I met this guy in the north, a great, great guy, I remember. And, you know, when I was thinking about it, I thought, you know what, a job would be quite handy because I could earn a few South African rand, was the local currency. It's not going to make me a rich man by any means, but basically what that helped me was to preserve my own sort of bank balance to enable me to have the sustainability and the longevity to keep traveling around the world on my own sort of budget. So I thought it'd be useful to get this little job. So I went back down to Cape Town and I went to the market. And I met the people who were in the market. So it wasn't the guy in the north that had sent me down there with this little business card. I handed it over to the guy on the market who was the manager. These are big markets. It wasn't like, you know, your sort of high street market in a market town in England or, you know, somewhere in the UK. This was, these were big sort of touristy markets and they were selling arts and crafts. So all this stuff was being bought in the north from Zimbabwe, Zambia, And then they were being shipped down, you know, in trucks, in vehicles, and they were selling it in the south to slightly more affluent sort of tourist market. Yeah. And so I got a job on the market as a salesman. I mean, I was a pretty lousy salesman at first, but I learned, you know, off some of the other staff. And so the staff members were predominantly white Afrikaans, and there was a few black guys that worked on the market as well. quite interesting because they lived out of town. So they lived on a township which was about 10 kilometres up the road, about 6-7 miles outside of Cape Town. Big township. We're talking several thousand sort of people at the time, and again, you know, 25 years ago. And there was one particular incident where, I think it was a bank holiday or something, and ordinarily, so they would get in the vans and we would drive them back to like a rendezvous point. And this was like a petrol station somewhere in the suburbs of Cape Town. And I think they'd pick up a local train from there. Yeah. And they would, that would, that train would essentially bus them back in towards the township. And that was how they kind of came to and from. But because it was bank holiday, so the black Africans that worked on the market, and they were doing quite a lot of the maintenance work and working on the arts and crafts and the curios, as they were called, they needed to get back home, right, in the evening, even though it's the bank holiday. But the trains weren't running. So I remember the boss came to me, and he was an African sort of white chap. And I'd got to know him really, really well. And he said to me, he said, I've got to, because I was a driver, I had a driving license. So I was doing some of the van driving and delivering people and, you know, dropping people off and running errands and all the rest of it for the markets. That was part of what I did. And so the boss came to me and he said, I need to get these guys back to the township. Reason being, trains aren't running, it's bank holiday, yada, yada, yada. So I was like, okay. He said, so what can I help you with? And he said, well, he said, we're gonna drive back to my place first of all, and then he said, we'll then take a run back, and we'll pick them up, and then he said, we'll basically proceed to take them to the township, and I said, okay, fine. I said, why don't we take the guys out to your home or your suburb? He said, no. He said, I'm not having that. He said, we need to go back to mine first. Trust me, it'll make sense. We drive back to mine. We'll come back to the market. We'll pick up the guys. We'll leave them just sat here, just they can just relax. And then we'll drive to the township. So I thought, okay, fair enough. He doesn't want the guys, you know, going to the area where he lives. He doesn't want to see, you know, the guys to see where he actually lives in the suburb of Cape Town, as it were. So that sort of sent alarm bells straight away, because I thought, well, clearly there's this divide. You know, the two sort of cultures don't necessarily trust each other. And I kind of understood that. The manager, the guy in charge, he didn't want these black Africans to know where he lived. I thought it was a little bit sad in a way. But, you know, there were these tensions, like I said. And so we went back. We ended up going back to his place. And I kid you not, he basically went into the house, this chap, and he brought out a handgun. And he basically said to me, hey, have you ever used one of these before? And I'm like, whoa. I said, listen, I said, I have handled one, but only because my grandfather took me to a gun club when I was a kid. So this was you remember they changed all the laws in the UK after the Dunblane incident up in Scotland. But my grandfather, before all that, was a keen sort of amateur shot, and he used to go to the local gun clubs, and he used to fire off on the ranges, you know, and hit a few targets. So when I was a teenager, he took me down to the gun clubs a couple of times just for a bit of target practice. So I had like small experience with a revolver, as it were, with a basic firearm. And this guy, the manager of this market, said, "Have you ever used one of these?" And I said, "Well, limited experience, you know, kind of thing. I'm not too happy about that." And he said, well, he kind of handed it to me, gave me a quick overview of the weapon and said, right, if you need to use this, he said, don't hesitate. He said, well, we're going somewhere where it's going to be a bit dodgy, you know, and he said, we need to get these guys back, because I'm obligated to help them get back to the township, get back home tonight. So there I was, and this thing was in the glove box, you know, sort of tucked away, this small revolver, and I'm a young bloke with very little life experience really at that stage of the game. And we go back to the township and we pick up the black African guys that had been working on the market. And there was about 8 to 10 of these lads, and they all piled into the back of this big VW Transit sort of panel van thing, big white van. And then we drove the 10 kilometres out towards the township. And as we drove inside, the sun was starting to go down and we're having to stop every couple of hundred yards to go over these big speed bumps, like these sleeping policemen. Now there's a big sort of pause over the bumps and we drive on a bit further. We end up having to drive something like 2 or 3 miles inside of the township. I mean, this township was such a built-up area. There's so much habitation in there. There's a lot of bodies in there. There was something like 7,000 people living in there, from what I was told. And then, and the boss basically reminded me, remember this guy that I'm with that's driving, he said, remember the gun. He said, if you have to use it, if we end up getting followed and we have to use this, he said, don't hesitate to pull that gun if you need it. And he said, I suggest you get it out of the glove box. So I'm holding this thing and my hands were like literally shaking. Yeah, because I'm thinking, Jesus, right, is it that sort of hostile in here? And we're driving in and we're driving all over these bumps and we're heading up deeper into the township. And the sun's going down. It's about 6-7 o'clock at night. And then all of a sudden, this kind of like small open-backed pickup truck comes towards us on the road. And of course, we have to slow down for one of these speed bumps, don't we? The oncoming vehicle has to do the same, so he slows down as well. And as we're going over the bump, the driver and his kind of co-pilot, his passenger, and all the guys in the back, it looked like they'd been out on the roads working or whatever, construction. So there's a bunch of guys in the back all stood up with like shovels and pickaxes. And we look at them, they look at us, they clock the fact that there's two white guys driving this VW panel van in their township. We're about 2 miles inside of the township and we've stopped to negotiate and navigate this speed bump. And we've got several more speed bumps to negotiate on the 2 miles to get the hell out of there. And all of a sudden, the boss that was driving, he just floors this vehicle. So pedal to the metal, he floors it. And there's this like ugly noise as the vehicle kind of like accelerates down the street, like, you know, kind of full speed. He drops a gear, floors it down the road. And he's looking in the mirror and he's looking like that and he's saying, shit, shit. He said, they're turning round. He could see the reverse lights. And he said, remember what I said. And my hands were like that, shaking. And how the hell we got out of there in one piece, because we were going over the speed bumps like bang, bang, crash, bang. And it felt like the bottom end of the van was going to drop off and fall out and the axles were going to drop off the vehicle. But it was like, it was just something out of a tense movie scene in my mind. Suddenly we bounce over about a dozen or so speed bumps every 200 meter interval. We cover the distance we need to get out of the main entry exit point in the township. And somehow miraculously we're back onto the open highway and it's sort of smooth tarmac. And the van was sort of like ruggedly sort of still tanking down the road. It just sort of held together, God knows how. And we're back sort of on the highway now, sort of in sort of almost sort of darkness, heading back towards kind of Cape Town proper. But that really put the wind up me. And it kind of, it dawned on me, you know, just how much tension there was and how much risk there was perhaps in that country. I mean, you don't necessarily think about it. But, yeah,
you only think about the consequences if something really happens and then you get the fear. But if you're living fearless and then nothing really happens, then you can't really judge it on anything. But if something does happen and it's a close call, then that's when you start assessing everything. So when did you join the army then? What age? When did you come back then from the world trip and then join the army? Was that a plan to join the army straight away?
Yeah, so later on, so I did that year's travel. I ended up, long story short, I ended up joining the police for a few years. That was a career that I did locally with Thames Valley Police. But I was interested again in something a bit sort of, a bit of a bigger sort of perhaps more global challenge. So the idea of the armed forces again appealed to me. And I ended up taking a sabbatical from the police after only about 3 short years of service. I ended up going off to do a bit more work around the world. And I was working as a diver in various locations because I was teaching, I was instructing. And that was just a personal interest.
You've done a lot, Jamie.
I've done a lot, yeah. I crammed a lot in.
What was the police like for 3 years? What was it like being in the police force for 3 years?
Yeah, enjoyed it. I mean, listen, it's not an easy job. And I've said this, you know, to many groups that I've spoken to. I'd say that was a life education in itself because, of course, you're dealing with, you know, the good guys. You know, you're dealing with people that are perhaps, you know, just innocent sort of victims of crime or aggrieved members of society for whatever reason. And, you know, there's a lot of good people out there in society, let's not forget. And you're there to serve. But, you know, you're also dealing with the darker side of life in the police. And there was, you know, there was incidents that, you know, that kind of stayed with me, you know, where, you know, I had, so I was privy to sort of murder investigations that I assisted, you know, colleagues in the CID department. You know, I wasn't a detective. I was only a police constable kind of in uniform, but occasionally I'd get sort of seconded across to help out on sort of bigger, wider sort of murder investigations. And some of those incidents and things that, you know, that I kind of heard of and, you know, was subject to as part of the investigations kind of stayed with me in my mind. And it was, it's interesting, you know, but a lot goes on out there, a lot of stuff that doesn't even get reported as well, you know, perhaps not within the public interest or, you know, deemed... perhaps, I don't know, just not necessarily suitable for the media to report. And of course, you know, sometimes a lot of things, you know, society, I think, largely is protected from certain harrowing events, because I think it would probably be quite depressing if you heard exactly what was going on all the time across a typical kind of force area. But there's a lot of things that happen, and there's a lot of pieces that the police are there to kind of serve for and sort of pieces to pick up, as it were.
Did that affect you being in the police force? Seeing that shot?
I did. I mean, I'll admit I found things a little bit depressing. You know, it's not always kind of happy-go-lucky. And you've kind of got to constantly nurture your mental health, well-being, I think, as an officer in that job. I think that's important that you do that. And you keep yourself on the straight and narrow and you keep yourself well. So, I mean, I used to tap into, you know, a lot of sport, and I used to be a keen runner and keep myself fit and active kind of outside of the job, which kind of helped me to cope with the rigours of the job on the inside. Because, you know, with the nature of what you're dealing with, sort of day shift, late shift, night shift, constant rotational shift patterns, it takes its toll on the body, and all of that kind of takes its toll on the mind. So you've got to nurture your health and well-being, like I said. But I did enjoy the job largely, but I just felt that, you know, there was perhaps more to life than potentially another 25 years in that career. So hence my interest, you know, went back towards, you know, the thought process of joining the army. And then I did that. So I took that sabbatical. As I said, I ended up doing a bit of travel around the world, doing some expedition work, doing some dive work in various locations. And then following that, about a year, as it were, sort of back on the road, travelling. I came back and I ended up going off to university. So that was later for me. So I was a mature student. I went off to do a languages degree. And
what language?
I did Scandinavian languages, actually. There was some influence in my family. So I've on my sort of mother's side, it's a bit sort of distant, but there was a bit of influence there. And I was kind of curious and I thought, interesting to go and spend some time out in Scandinavia, perhaps. And being a mature student, it didn't really matter what degree that I did. I was just interested to kind of get the experience of gaining the degree and kind of having that life experience, as it were. And I thought it might come in handy kind of for future careers and the options that are available. So I decided to sort of follow my sort of instinct on that, head off to university for a few years, end up living in Norway in my second year, and sort of blagging a year, sort of working with a centre that did a lot of sort of mountaineering sort of training. And I loved all that. I mean, I was in my element, learning new skills, kind of climbing and skiing and ski touring. I took my dive gear out there. I was diving in the deep fjords as well. And that was a lot of fun. I ended up teaching some of the locals. And that was a good bit of, helped me to sustain my time over there. Because the beer's about... Well, it was about £10 a pint, and that was 20 years ago. So gives you a bit of pocket money anyway, if you can find a bit of local work, which really helped me. And then also during my time at university, so I actually ended up volunteering. So I joined something called Cambridge University Officer Training Corps. It's quite an interesting unit attached to the university. And I so I had exposure with the perhaps what the British Army had to offer. So for the record, Cambridge OTC was a bit of a recruitment workshop for prospective, you know, younger students, you know, people that were aspiring to perhaps join the army, be it regular service full time or reservists, and I had this fantastic exposure. So I did like a lot of fam visits, what they call familiarisation visits, and I was getting to go off with various regiments and corps, and for like these long weekends and see what it was all about, and kind of get thoroughly spoilt staying in sort of posh officers' messes and having fancy black tie dinners, and kind of during the daytime you'd get kind of familiarisation with the various tools and assets that, say, the infantry possessed, or the Royal Engineers, or the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, or the Royal Armoured Corps. So you get to sort of play with all the tools and equipment that the British Army had to offer, and so therefore it was great exposure. That's what I'm getting at. And it was food for thought about the future, like what was I interested in, what line perhaps did I consider taking, if indeed that was going to be a career option for me. And then so the other part of it was I went on, if you like, with the OTC. I did a lot of courses. My commanding officer was keen as mustard, quite honestly, and he knew that I'd been in Norway for a year as a student, having a lot of fun and games out there in the mountains. So he immediately, he was a keen skier himself, this gentleman, he sent me back to do a ski course. I ended up doing a skiing instructor's course. I think I did a ski tour leader's course, which is basically like mountain leader, but on skis, sort of guiding groups. I did a PTI's course. So I had a lot of opportunities. You know, I did driving courses up to sort of HGV class one, you know, the big rigs. So I got some great experience. And then I was considering the future, so life beyond that unit, so life beyond the OTC or Officer Training Corps, and what lay ahead potentially. And it was put to me, I think it could have been the CO actually, said to me, would you be interested in doing All Arms Commando course, you know, the Marines? And I thought, yeah, I would be, because I was really interested in that, remember, as a kid.
How old were you?
When I left school. So by that stage, I was sort of 26, 27 perhaps.
So pretty old to be doing.
Yeah, I was an older recruit. Yeah, yeah. So I was probably 6-7 years behind my contemporaries when I went to university. I was a mature student, you know, a mature student sort of in reality and in inverted commas as far as the university was concerned. But the OTC was a great opportunity, you know, for me to sort of test the water as to whether I was interested in a career, whether it was full-time or reserve service. And so it was put to me about this commando course, All Arms Commando, but I couldn't get the time off that I needed from my dean of faculty in the languages department at uni. Couldn't get the time off. I was politely denied that period of time that I needed to go off and do that military course. So I went back to the boss, basically the CO, and said, sorry, sir, it's not happening. And then I think more or less straight away, somebody had suggested, well, why don't you see if you can do P Company? And I was like, well, what's P Company? And they said, well, P Company's the regimental selection for the parachute regiment. And of course I'd heard of the paras, para reg. And I thought, well, that's going to be a challenge. That's going to be, you know, that's going to be tough. That's going to be something to aspire to. Similarly to the Marines, it was the challenge that I was still looking for. Remember, I'm still mid-20s, so I'm still hungry for that adventure, that challenge. And I end up, it was a little bit shorter course. So again, I knew I probably wouldn't get the permission, but I just blagged it anyway. I just went and kind of ended up playing catch up with the kind of academia afterwards. So that course was about a month full time up at Catterick in North Yorkshire. And I surprised myself, actually. I found the course, you know, bloody difficult. I mean, it was nails. I mean, anyone that says otherwise is probably lying through their back teeth. But P Company, for me, and for, you know, respect to all the paras or ex-paras that are out there, It's a damned difficult course. It's very high speed, a lot of short, sharp events. You know, you've got to score points on everything, and it culminates in a test week, and you're doing log runs, you're doing stretcher races, you're doing the milling, you know, the boxing, standing toe-to-toe with your opponent in the ring. And you're doing all these short, sharp sort of squad runs as well. Everything's high speed, like max speed. And you're literally, you feel like you're being beasted within an inch of your life. So that taught me a hell of a lot about my own personal character. Above all, it taught me about, you know, digging deep within my character to sort of really pull something gritty out of the bag in terms of my own personal performance, as it were. Because I think in something like Para Reg or indeed the Marines, you have got to be a veritable athlete, not only in the physical sense, but in the mind, because you've got to be able to sustain your performance over long periods of time. You know, I mean, the selections kind of dictate that, but not just that. It's like the job dictates that. So being a soldier in one of the more kind of elite regiments, you know, you've got to dig deep for long periods of time in the patrols on the ground, and you've got to sustain yourself in kind of arduous environments, you know, and that takes a lot of get up and go and motivation and hunger. And not everybody's got that. It's not everybody's cup of tea. So that's why it's a little bit different from perhaps kind of just regular soldiering.
Yeah, it seems a bit extreme, but do you think that element of doing that training has helped you today after your crash to then never fucking quit, keep pushing yourself to the limits, dig deep within, to then realise that you can still give more?
I think, to be fair, it's a great question. I've had this a lot. So I think, yes, my military, you know, experience and training, and I did a lot in terms of training, in terms of selections, in terms of exposure to the wider British Army. I did a lot. I feel like I gained a lot of experience, and I travelled a lot with them, and I went all over the world. And then, you know, I eventually went sort of SF selection with the SAS, with 2-1 SAS for a number of years. But it's not so much of a boast in my case, because the truth is I've got nothing really to report on any of that front, other than I did it. I kind of qualified. I kind of went through the selection process, like I mentioned. I kind of gained the CAP badges, and I kind of served for a period of X. I went all over the world. I sampled lots of different environments and sort of worked in, you know, very extreme different temperature ranges, from abject cold to, you know, seriously hot locations on the planet. But I never really went anywhere in terms of operational deployment. It never quite happened for me, because I got injured in the summer of 2007, which I'll come on to. But in order to perhaps answer the question, I think the fight in me was always there from a young age. I think you're perhaps born with it. You've either got it in the bank, as it were. You possess it or you don't. And I think that's true for a lot of individuals. They're deep down, they're true fighters, you know, in that sense, or they're probably just a bit average, you know. And I think I was always a fighter. But what I will say about the military is that the kind of training that I went through, whether it was selection for Para Reg or selection for UK Special Forces, it definitely teaches you to dig that bit deeper within your personal character, to really find the depths of what you're truly capable of, that you perhaps didn't believe that you were capable of. And it takes you to places that you probably ordinarily are unlikely to ever go to otherwise, if you understand. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the fundamental difference. Having gone through those kind of processes in life, I learned as an individual to dig very, very deep and to bloody well hold on at all costs. And I think that part, as well as being a kind of a natural born fighter perhaps, but that learning to really dig deep and hold on as a result of military service combined was perhaps what helped me. And it's just a suggestion, but it was perhaps what helped me to ultimately hold on, you know, when I sustained later on, you know, a major trauma and indeed, you know, a huge, you know, third degree burns injury.
When did you learn how to fly planes?
So that was something that I did as a personal ambition in the summer of 2007. And again, it was something that cropped up in my mind. You probably get the idea and the sense now that...
You jump on anything that you've got up here.
For sure. So I was always one of these guys that, rather than be down the kind of pub, you know, kind of elevating bicep and kind of talking the talk, I was one of these guys that not only would talk the talk, but if I came up with an idea that I felt quite compelled to go off and do in life, I did it. And I was one of these guys that would also walk the walk. That's what I'm saying. And so I like to get on. And again, I like to challenge myself. And the idea came up that I was very interested to learn to fly. And that was simply born because as a kid, my late grandfather, so my dad's dad, he was a keen sort of aviation spotter. And he also trained as a pilot, you know, at the back end of the Second World War, but he was very young in service with the RAF, and the war sort of wound up. But he was a spotter, and he worked in the kind of aviation sector for British Aerospace Engineering. And as a young kid, he used to take me to Luton Airport. So there I was, sort of face pressed up against the boundary fence with a broken binocular. And I'm looking through to the other side at the active runway. And, you know, watching all the big boys kind of throttling up the engines and getting ready for sort of pre-flight checks and obviously taxiing out to the active runway and takeoff. So I would watch all that going on in the distance as a young boy. And that was absorbing, you know, I was kind of inspired by that whole scene as a young lad. And I thought maybe one day I'd like to learn to fly. So years later, the kind of maybe the seed was there and I kind of wanted to act on that, right? Remember, because the kind of character that I was. So I got a bit of downtime, summer of 2007. I'd just been given the nod with my regiment that I was about to deploy out to just general operational deployment. We had a tasking on, and it was definitely going to happen that autumn of 2007. So I had a little bit of downtime. I had about 6 to 8 weeks prospectively, and I chose to fulfill the ambition. So I came to London. I managed to persuade the powers that be at the US Embassy that I was good for it, that I wasn't a sort of a some kind of risk, because remember, this was post 9/11, and they were obviously a bit tetchy about who they were going to give visas to, for especially for foreigners to learn to fly within US airspace, for obvious reasons. So I persuaded them that I wasn't a risk, got my visa, and I was armed with that, if you will, and I went off to the States. And I specifically chose Florida because of the likelihood of you know, some decent weather over perhaps a 6 week period, and the likelihood I was going to get the flying done in a good, you know, reasonable time frame and not get rained off. And and when I was out there, if I kind of speed up and fast forward, I was a month into the course, and I was now pilot in command, so flying solo, just flying between small municipal airports in the local kind of part of Florida.
After just 1 month, you were learning how to fly alone?
Yeah, just after 1 month.
Is that... Do you become a fast learner, though, or is that...
Well, I think, no, fairly probably average. I don't think I was sort of, you know, particularly extraordinary in that sense. You know, you get to a certain point, and then you go solo. And then you're sort of qualified. You get signed off to fly as a solo pilot. So you can then go pilot in command and fly the aircraft on its own. And you're then hour building. So that's what I was doing. I was doing my hours, sort of just small little hops, or indeed going up into the local airspace, into the local pattern over the aerodrome. And on this one particular day, I had an engine fire. So what my first alert was, I looked out the left-hand canopy and there was a thin streak of like visible yellow-orange flame. And I did a double take and I thought, yep, sure enough, that's flame. And then no sooner as I sort of made my final turn now into wind, approaching the active runway down below, the fire then immediately breached the cockpit down below in the footwell. So I looked down, I saw flames coming in around my feet and ankles. So as I'm descending, the flames were starting to build up within that small two-seater cockpit. And I'm having to think on my feet and I'm getting flustered and I'm thinking about it all, sort of left hand on the flight control stick, right hand on the throttle. And I'm descending, and the fire's building up. And all of a sudden, I probably get to about half the height. So I'm now about 500 feet indicated on my altimeter on the instrument panel. And I make a decision that I'm going to actually glide and veer away and glide in. So I veer away from the concrete runway below and head towards a grassy stretch and an embankment in the distance. And the reason being is I'm going for soft ground. And I'd already decided up there, if you will, that I was going to glide in and I was going to exit that cockpit early because of the rate of increase and build up of fire that was happening in the cockpit. I thought, I'm not hanging around in this thing. So it was building up quite quickly as I was descending. And I came up with this kind of exit plan or game plan, if you will, to exit the aircraft earlier. So the idea was to glide in, get very low level. And that's exactly what I did. So I systematically switched everything off in sequence, removed the headset, unbuckled my harness, opened the canopy door, very low level, as I mentioned earlier, 15 feet above the ground, thereabouts. I was able to get on the seat onto the left wing and jump. I landed in long, soft grass. It was a relatively soft landing, but I did come in like a sack of spuds. I landed feet first, but then there was a secondary impact. So face first is the grass, soft ground, but the grass is like razor blades in the tropics. And had a bilateral nasal fracture. I had supraorbital eye socket fractures above both eyes. It fractured. Multiple soft tissue lacerations from the sharp grass. I popped a collarbone, hyperextended my left index finger, which fractured. Inadvertently ruptured my colon, my large intestine, internally. Lacerated one side of my liver, also internally, which was now bleeding. But the worst of it was the life changer and the showstopper for me was the fact that I was, for the record, I was 63% third and fourth degree burns. Fourth degree burns means that there was exposed bone. So remember I said where the fire breached in the lower part of the cockpit? So when my feet were operating the rudder pedals, my shins took the longer period of exposure to the flame and hence the exposed bone with the tibia bones on my shins. So I was a massive trauma all in all, and I was very lucky that I got airlifted from the scene within probably about 15 minutes. I had an ambulance on the ground, so a vehicular, you know, small ambulance. They must have hit me with a bit of morphine because suddenly the pain was kind of alleviated somewhat. Because just before that, the pain was kind of off the charts. It was absolutely hideous, indescribable is the only word that I could, you know, kind of honor it, quite frankly, because it was that hideous. And I didn't think I was going to be able to hold on. So when they gave me that little syringe of morphine, life was pretty damn good. But I knew in my subconscious, in my mind, that it was really bad. It was exceedingly, you know, bad for me, and the likelihood was I wasn't going to make it. So I got airlifted a very short time later. There was probably a helicopter on scene within about another 5 minutes. Airlifted me to Orlando Regional, which is a very premier hospital trauma facility in Florida, in that part of the USA. And the rest is history. So I was lucky. I had those medics, those doctors, those nurses, interventional radiologists, physiotherapists, all manner of surgical specialists working on me 24/7, round the clock for the next 6 months of my life. The bill, the medical bill, it's not a boast, but just to give you an indication of what they had to do for me, and that was 2007, so 14 years ago now, but the bill was more than $2.6 million. So that gives you an indication of how much work they did for me. Mm. And yeah, the rest is history. I mean, I was luckily, God knows how, but somehow miraculously able to pull through the trauma. But it took me a long time. So 6 months drug-induced, 2 years in the hospital. So they flew me back to the UK. I was on the burns unit in Chelmsford, in Essex, for a couple of months. I was in Stoke Mandeville for about 16 months or so, for a very long period, in the burns unit in Aylesbury, Stoke Mandeville. So 2 years hospital. I had 62 operations under general anaesthetic, and we talked about the need to fight and the need to hold on. So, I mean, that's testimony right there. 2 years in the hospital, 62 surgeries under general. And that to me was the hardest thing that I ever had to go through. I mean, you know, I kind of talk a little bit about the history and the build up towards getting injured in the flying incident in Florida. But to be fair, all of that paled into insignificance in terms of what I inadvertently was forced to pull out of the bag in order to survive the burns.
Yeah. Tell me this, Jamie, with the pain you went through, the 2 years, all the operations, everything, is there a part of you ever think that you wish you'd have died on the plane?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I make no bones about hiding this because I think it's important from a mental health kind of perspective, and I think it can kind of inadvertently help others. So that's why I do partly what I do now as a speaker. And I go out there and I do a bit of public speaking and talk to all manner of different audiences. And I have been doing that for a number of years. But I honestly believe that, look, if I can come through that gravity of trauma and that gravity of injury and go on to make a relative success of life in terms of active health and active recovery. You know, I mean, I've learned that you don't have to be a Superman, but it's good to be somewhat active to get on, right? To feel better about yourself and to promote your own self-esteem. So I feel that, it's important that I share it. And as you touched on, you know, I reached the very lowest ebb of humanity, frankly. So in my own journey, in my own testimony, what I mean by that, and I'm going to quote a very tiny aspect of my story as is written in the book, as is published. So I became the adjunct of machinery, a living receptacle for machines, tubes, wires, and powerful pharmaceuticals. Now, if you can picture that, that was me when I was laid up in intensive care for those 6 months. You know, I've got a machine breathing for me. I've got a yellow tube, they call it nasogastric, feeding me into the stomach through the nose. I've got, you know, renal failure going on. So I've got dialysis machines kind of filtering my blood 24/7. You know, I've had, you know, pneumonia, you know, where the lungs have been infected. I've had septicemia, so blood poisoning. And all these very powerful antibiotics are the pharmaceuticals keeping me alive for those former years of the trauma. And the truth is, I got to about 18 months down the road and I ended up, you know, at my lowest ebb because, frankly, the truth is I just didn't want to fight anymore. So to give you an analogy, I felt like the boxer in the ring, right? If you can picture that. But I wasn't on round 12, you know, kind of fighting and kind of taking a few knocks and a few punches still and getting tired after round 12, like a boxer. I was actually like on round 4,127 after 18 months. And you know what? I was just tired of being in the ring, if you can understand. I was tired of being in the hospital, tired of being in the fight of my life, tired of the open wounds, tired of getting taken down to theatre, sometimes twice a week even, you know. It was just ridiculous. And the wounds weren't healing, the wounds weren't closing up. And I just thought, what life is this? How can I possibly go on? I mean, having had the life that I'd had, gone from being an elite soldier, you know, up here, to sort of ground zero, what life is this? And I couldn't see the future, and I couldn't see the light. So I made a concerted decision that I wanted to check out, and I considered going down the road of, you know, getting that assistance to do so with Dignitas.
Switzerland.
And assisted suicide. Yeah, that was the journey that I kind of thought was the logical way out. You see, I didn't want to do something daft. I couldn't sort of be one of these guys that, I don't know, on the black market picked up some dodgy firearm or took a bottle of pills and drank like half a bottle of whiskey or something. That just wasn't me. You know, I'd come this far in life. I couldn't just end it through some messy, sloppy sort of ordeal. That wasn't me. I was always a kind of an orderly type of guy and I needed to check out in an orderly fashion. But for me, Dignitas was a viable, credible, kind of neat option, shall we say. And in my logical mind, that was the way to go because I didn't want to be here. remember, I was 18 months in, tired of being in the fight. I couldn't do it any longer. Every day was a mission. And I was in a very, very dark place mentally and really, really just did not want to be here anymore. But luckily, I managed to turn a corner. So I had some, let's just say, external kind of influence and assistance in the form of a gentleman from the ministry. So a guy came from a church parish. I believe it was over Oxford Way. And this gentleman was from sort of deeper Africa. I think he was on some kind of secondment. So I remember they said, you know, would you like this visit? And I said, well, whatever. I couldn't care less at that stage, quite frankly. But they kind of talked me into having this visit from this guy. He just said he wanted to come and visit me, and he was from the church over Oxford Way. And to my kind of astonishment, I was expecting some white guy in a dog collar to rock up, you know, from the church. And it wasn't. It was a black guy in, like, civilian clothing and with an African accent. And he got chatting to me, and I just, you know, in a way, there was something about this guy that sort of resonated with me. And maybe because I'd spent time in Africa myself, and remember, I'd worked with some of those guys down in Cape Town. And we got chatting, and we kind of just talked about life, and we shared snippets of our former life and our history and blah, blah, blah. And I told him I'd been to Africa, and he was quite impressed by that, you know. And anyway, we got talking, and somehow he managed to tap into my sort of psychology a little bit. And he was listening to me. That was the important thing. He was listening to me. And when I said, look, mate, this is what I want. I don't want to be here any longer because of the, you know, the kind of grotesque position that I find myself facing in this life, having been through what I've been through, and I just want to check out. That's where I was. And he was listening. He was taking it all in. And he turned around and said to me, you know what? He said, I understand it. I get it. He said, I tell you what, I'll help you and I'll take you. And I'm like, what, are you for real? He was the first bloke that had actually said to me, yeah, I'll basically drive you out to Switzerland and help you do and achieve what you need to do. And you know me, or perhaps you get the sense of me,
yeah.
I would have done it.
Yeah,
100%. All I needed was some bloke to effectively hold my hand, help me out, put me in a motor vehicle, drive me down there, and I would have done the deed. Because that was the logical way out, and that's what I was looking at. That's what I wanted. And if you like, quite cleverly, he gave me an ultimatum, and he said to me, look, he said, you know, I'm willing to help you out, but I want you to do something for me. Okay, what is that, you know? And he said, I want you to hold on for one calendar month, you know, just hold on for me. And I was pretty mortified at the time. I was like, you know, horrified at that statement, because I couldn't do it. Like, another month just felt like an eternity to me, given the condition that my body was in and the very, very lowest ebb state of mind that I described. I didn't want to hold on any longer. He said, look, if you hold on for me, he said, I will help you. So what choice did I have? And that was the deal, take it or leave it. So as friends, if you like, almost as business associates, we shook hands, and that was it. Anyway, life started to turn a bit of a corner. Not overnight, might I add, but life started to turn a bit of a corner over the course of the next month. And I remember going for a surgery during the course of the following week, and my consultant, who was an Indian gentleman, came in one morning. He was sort of wagging his tail, saying, look, guess what? We've got a new, we've got some fresh skin that's been harvested. And basically, I knew where that comes from. It comes from, like, cadaver or some sort of the proceeds of some kind of surgery where they harvest the skin. And then basically, I receive the skin as the burns victim, and they can do that specialized grafting to put it onto my wounded areas to give me kind of cover to allow my own cellular structure underneath to try to knit together and heal. And that was the idea behind all these kind of skin grafts. And I had many such operations. And he said, he came in wagging his tail, the Indian burns consultant. And he said, you know, I'm really excited. He said, we've got the skin that we need. It's coming in like 2 days' time. He said, so I'll take you back to theatre and we'll do this big operation on you. Anyway, we did the op. I went down again, I did the op. And when I remember coming to in the recovery room in Stoke Mandeville, And you know what? For the first time in many, you know, all those months, my skin, my wounds didn't feel so painful. It wasn't so uncomfortable. And I wasn't sort of screaming blue murder like I normally was, you know, kind of like begging for more kind of painkillers or analgesia. And I felt somewhat better. I couldn't quite get my head around it, but I felt better. I felt stronger. So something was happening, right, in the body, in the healing. And indeed, about 4 or 5 days later, 100 or so hours until the nurses are kind of compelled to take the dressings down for the first time post these skin graft surgeries, because they need to check on it. They need to clean the wounds, clean the, like, fresh dressings. They took all the dressings down and did the visual kind of observation of all my body and the wounds. And they were, all of a sudden, they were like really animated and excited, saying, "Wow, this is amazing. Your wounds are like starting to show real visible signs of healing here. That surgery that the consultant did on you has had a tremendous result." He said, you should feel proud about this, you know. And indeed, in my mind, there wasn't so much pain. There was something going on. So the healing was starting in body and mind.
Within.
And that was the start of me turning the corner. So with big trauma, they talk about the point at which you start to turn a corner for the better and you start to recover. It's not easy to put a handle on that and to put a finger on it exactly. But for me, that was the start of the turning point. But for the record, I want to make it clear that it wasn't like a right angle that I turned and then suddenly all was good.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I went around that street corner. It felt like the curvature of the earth.
Process.
Remember, that journey was a 2-year kind of turn.
For the trauma, is that, we all go through trauma in life. Everybody's traumas are different from everybody else's. Is it to accept the trauma first, understanding, okay, it's happened? Do you think that's the moment that you need to accept to then heal?
I think there was a number of things going on. So I think probably fundamentally the process of the physical healing, because remember, this was medically for the record, I was 63% third and fourth degree burns, massive open areas across the total body surface area of Jamie Hull. So the physical healing was crucially important for me. If I could see progress or learn of progress through the doctors and through the nurses that were observing the body and the wounds, etc., and looking after me, you know, 24/7 in that burns unit, then if I was receiving that kind of positive information, then for me that was having a knock-on effect. And I was the kind of guy, remember, logical thinking mindset. I needed to see results. I needed to see progress. I needed that development, because that was kind of who I was, what I was all about. Remember, I was always about self-development, self-progress, and trying to get on in the world. Mm-hmm. And even being a burns victim, I just needed to heal. I needed to progress in that department to enable me to take the next steps in, you know, tentatively in the new life, if you're with me.
Looking for a bit of hope to then progress, to re-rise. Do you think because things weren't working for the first 18 months because you weren't believing in yourself and you weren't believing that there was any hope that you wanted to die, so it wasn't really affected it? But then as soon as that man came into your life, and then as soon as you got a glimmer of hope, then you started believing, then you start getting fitter, then you start getting stronger, then the confidence starts to come. Like, it all comes down to the way we think, the way we see the world.
Absolutely.
Like, that's what I always try and promote, is everything, you are what you see, and you are what you think, you are what you speak. Like, when you're down and out, man, it's easy to jump and go, fuck it, I don't want anything. But when you start getting glimmers of hope and then you start getting that self-belief, shit, man, that's the golden key. And that's where your inspiration comes in. That's where people will be watching going, fuck me, what have I actually got to complain about?
Yeah.
Because we all live in luxury. Majority is living luxury. We just love to complain and moan about stupid shit.
I mean, just for me to be sat here now all these years later just thinking about it, you know, I've got my back to the high back of this chair. You know, it's a comfortable chair, granted, but given the condition of my body back then, I wouldn't have been able to sit against the back of this chair because the wounds were so painful. So just to be living life in kind of abject sort of comfort, shall we say, is an absolute luxury.
It's a blessing.
And I learned these things.
When were you on fire? Was it when you inside the plane, or was it when a plane crashed?
No, within the confines of the cockpit before I managed to exit.
So you still managed to think of all that while on fire?
Yeah, so for me, it was a case of falling back on my training because it was a drill that I was taught, just an emergency drill, an emergency protocol for that type of aircraft. And it sounds complex, but it was actually relatively simple. Basically, following the dashboard, I just was able to turn everything off in sequence. So it was key to the ignition, the magnetos, the red switches, so alpha and bravo, off, off, master switch off, lights off, strobes off, fuel pump off, fuel selector valve rotate off, everything off, off, off in sequence. That was the emergency drill. So a shutdown procedure, and then glide in to and scrub off the airspeed. As I said, headset off, unbuckle harness, open door, and then that enabled me to exit.
Did you have any thoughts before you went on that plane? Was there anything to say that something's going to go wrong today? Did you have any gut feeling, or was everything just...
No, not necessarily. So at the beginning of the flight, you know, I was pretty happy. You know, by that stage, I was used to the routine. You know, I'd had a fair few hours under my belt.
Solo?
You know, solo. And I'd been solo for about 8 days. So, you know, in my mind, I was in good shape. And the weather was good. It was a bluebird day by all accounts, a few puffy clouds in the sky. So I felt pretty good about, you know, what I was doing, like any other day. But as fate would have it, it sort of took a very different turn. And little did I realise that I'd end up facing what I faced. I mean, unfortunate, but then when I look back, frankly, you know, now, I've long since learned to accept it. So, you know, bottom line for me, it took about 3 years of healing, that what I was describing earlier on in the physical sense, until I was physically healed. It took about 5 years mentally healing and acceptance. And over the course of time, sort of with great will and determination, I was able to take those tentative steps into a new life and then challenge myself in all kinds of new and perhaps unconventional ways that I hadn't kind of considered. So I did all sorts of things, lots of challenges, events. I did a lot of expeditions. I worked in the expedition sort of field, in the expedition world, led a number of expeds around the world for different teams and groups. Did a lot of scuba diving again, sort of climbed the ladder in the scuba diving world and went on to qualify as a very senior instructor with the diving organisation PADI that I do a bit with. And
you've climbed Kilimanjaro as well?
Yeah, I climbed Kilimanjaro.
That's unbelievable, Jamie. Honestly, it's fucking unbelievable, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy mountain, and it's about nearly... So it's, I think... from memory, it's just shy of 20,000 feet,
yeah,
or about just shy of 6,000 mm-hmm. meters. But that's, yeah, these things inspired me. And of course, you know, I got to benefit, if you will, as a beneficiary for certain charities that I was on the receiving end of, Help for Heroes, Blesma, Pilgrim Bandits. And these charities were inspirational to me. I got to work alongside like-minded wounded servicemen and women, and I got to go on various challenges and events in different locations around the world. And having that kind of camaraderie and that banter, you know, as teams, as groups, we kind of together we learned to sort of believe in each other and what we were capable of.
What was it like, Jamie, from being an impulsive kid to then traveling the world and trying to make something happen with your life, and then with all the burns, what was it like the first time you'd looked at yourself after everything you'd been through in the hospital? Was it a week, 6 months when you looked, and what were you thinking?
It was pretty awful, actually. I remember the nurse in Essex, and I'm not very good at the accent, but she was like, got to get you moving now, Jamie, got to get you moving, got to get you set up. And I'm like, what is going on? And this was like the beginning of the real journey, because remember, before that I'd been 6 months sort of drug induced, so I wasn't really that aware of what was going on. In fact, the only thing I remember from America, frankly, after the original airlift and being taken to the hospital and talking to doctors there, the only thing I then remember is like one female American accent, and that was my nurse in America, my sort of lead nurse. But you know, this Essex nurse, so 6 months on, she's talking to me and sort of bending my ear. I mean, perhaps I shouldn't say that because I lost most of the ear anyway, but she's sort of chewing it off. Maybe she was responsible. And she's basically yeah, bending my ear and sort of saying, got to get you moving now, got to get you sat up in bed. And there's this real fog. And I'm kind of like, what the hell, what's going on? And, you know, it was really confusing for me. Anyway, no sooner had I sort of realised where I was, and suddenly it dawned on me, and I'm now back in the UK. This nurse is speaking to me. And I mean, I just thought, oh my God, this is just horrendous. And the next thing she said to me was, okay, we're going to get you a mirror now, Jamie. You know, you're going to get you, you've got to have a look at yourself because there's been a bit of change, you know, because you've been burned. And she was quite matter of fact, you know, quite frank about it. So she brought me in this handheld mirror, and I basically had to take hold of it and look at myself for the first time. And I remember seeing myself, and back then, you know, this is sort of, 13 and a half years ago. My face was really quite swollen, and I remember being pretty horrified looking at myself in the mirror for the first time. The scars were really red and blotchy and swollen. I mean, there were still kind of like scabby bits on my face where I'd been recently, kind of had a bit of surgery and whatnot, because I'd had a lot of skin grafts. And that was a tough thing to swallow, yeah? And because I wasn't a bad-looking lad, you know? I mean, much like yourself, James, you know, I was a pretty smooth-looking operator.
Thank you for that.
You know, back in the day.
Still but, smooth, brother, you're still smooth. That's all real fucking skin grafts right enough. How many skin grafts have you had?
Maybe it's the Scottish genes. Who knows? But, you know, that... But yeah, I wasn't a bad-looking lad, mm-hmm. you know, in my younger years. And, you know, the burns did do a bit of a number on me, and a lot of skin grafts, it visibly changed my appearance. And, of course, in the early years, I had to get used to all of that and that real visible change of appearance. And, yeah, that was tough for me. And like I said, it took about 5 years to properly accept everything. So body, the change of facial appearance, and... not an easy thing, you
yeah.
know?
Because in today's society,
absolutely,
we're all you know. We're all judged by appearance. We all judge, but when you actually connect with somebody's soul, when you actually understand that everything's within, then it's just a mirror. It is just, but it's so difficult, especially for yourself. Because I know girls who are models who still struggle to walk around the streets. They've still got to be getting Botox and fake tits and fake lips to try and feel some sort of to keep up with society's needs.
Sure.
So. For yourself, who's got burns and stuff like that, how hard was it then to be walking in today's society with people looking all the time? Do you eventually get used to that, or do you ever feel like, what the fuck are you looking at? Or do you just kind of,
yeah.
okay, I understand I've got burns? Because we are nosy. Yeah. We do want to second glance and go, you want to know what's happened, or you want, people who are curious.
They are.
Is that difficult then to be walking at the start, or do you get used to it now?
Yeah, I cannot deny that in the very early stages for me, it was bloody hard. I mean, I felt very self-conscious. And for example, you know, it wasn't so bad in the hospital, because in the hospital, kind of like you're kind of institutionalized in a way. And you almost feel that, you know, you're permitted to look the way that you do as a victim of trauma, of injury, because you're in the hospital, right? And that's where people are there for all manner of wounds, injuries. And so it didn't really dawn on me so much in the hospital. Remember, I lived in the hospital for the first 2 years. You know, it might as well have been my residential address, Stoke Mandeville Burns Unit. But it wasn't until I got home, so back to my mother's in Leighton Buzzard in Bedfordshire initially, and I ventured out into the local cul-de-sac and sort of managed to start, you know, learning to walk a bit further. And then suddenly I'm walking down the street and I'm suddenly feeling pretty self-conscious because people are looking at me. And that was pretty tough. And I'd sort of shy away, you know, I'd sort of be sort of head down, just do my walking. And I didn't really want to look at anyone. I remember that. And I couldn't go down the high street, you know, where it was all going on with the markets and everyone coming and going from the banks, the shops and supermarkets. I didn't want to go there. You know, it was a tough thing for me. And it took me probably a number of weeks of just slowly, you know, very tentatively getting out there back in society and walking a little bit further and a bit further again before I kind of felt comfortable with being out in society again. And it was all weird, you know. I mean, you do notice people looking at you and people staring and almost doing a double take when you walk down the street. I've joked about it over the years, but it's kind of like you feel like you're a B-list celebrity. You know, like people look at you and look again in the street because, like, clearly they see something different. And but anyway, I mean, you know, over the course of time, I learned to accept it. Things happened. A couple of examples, you know, little things that I remember. I remember going to a doctor's surgery, and I'm in the waiting room, you know, with predominantly adults, like men and women, waiting to see the GP. And all of a sudden, there was this young girl, and she's probably only 3 or 4 years of age, and she's with her mum, you know, just sort of, I think she was kind of stood in between her mum's legs as she sort of sat on the chair. And she kind of bleats out in the public, and you know how these doctors' waiting rooms are quite quiet. And she sort of makes a remark and says, "Mummy, what happened to that man?" And her mother was clearly sort of, oh my God, she was like mortified. You know, a daughter should say such a thing in front of me, in front of the whole doctor's waiting room. And I just thought, I just felt compelled to sort of break the ice a little bit. And I just sort of leant forward on my chair and sort of looked at the girl and looked at the mum. And I just sort of said, "Look," I said, "it's okay." I said, "I had an injury. I got a burns injury. I was in a fire," and I just kind of kept it brief. And I didn't give her the long-winded version. but I remember sort of just breaking the ice in that respect and telling the story very vaguely and briefly to the little girl. And she was kind of like, "Ah," like this. And kids are kind of quite interesting. They're great like that because, you know, they're kind of...
innocent.
Yeah, they're listening. They're just taking it all in. And they don't really understand that, did they overstep the line?
Yeah.
Kind of thing by asking you. Whereas all the adults are like...
scared.
They look
at
me, again. They double take. But they're not necessarily going to ask me that question. You might get it in the pub or something. Some guy's had a couple of Dutch courage. And he leans across and says, "Hey, mate, what happened to you, if you don't mind me asking?" You know, he's feeling a bit confident. Mm-hmm. And I've had that before. You know, and depending on the mood that I'm in, sometimes I tell him for real what happened. Or sometimes I just shrug it off and I just say, "Yeah, whatever, I just had an accident, no big deal." Sort of move on.
I think that shows your character, man. Like, there's not many people would come through what you've come through, brother. Like, it's fucking unbelievable, mate. I'm inspired. Yeah. Like, I like to moan and complain about certain things. I'm a workhorse. Like, we just don't know what's round the corner. We don't know what kind of circumstances. We don't know what anybody's going to throw in front of us to then learn from, to grow from, to become that individual. Just so happens you've been through what you've been through, but you've not let it fucking quit, man. You've not let me say, "Okay, I'm just going to forgive and then go to Switzerland." Like, how close that was. Do you question your whole journey from everything you went through till now to then think, why has this happened to me? What's the reason for it?
Oh, mate, I mean, honest to God, literally, when I said like 3 years of healing, 5 years mentally, so when I was on that journey, I questioned a lot. I mean, I was constantly grieving the old me, so call it Jamie Hull version 1.0, you know, that guy. I was constantly grieving that guy. But it took me years to properly understand that he was never coming back, that I had to learn to accept version 2.0, you know, the new me, and work with the new toolbox.
Yeah, because you're still Jamie Hull.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And my new appearance and whatever. There'd been changes. You know, I've got some physical disability, you know, with the walking. I've got a bit of nerve damage or whatever. I've got some change of appearance, you know. But, you know, eventually I learned to properly accept it all. And I pinch myself now in a way that, you know, that thing happened to me and that I was able to survive that gravity of trauma and pull through. Like, I still don't really understand how on earth I was able to pull through that. And you know, because it was such a massive trauma. And, you know, but there was a massive grieving process that I went through, questioned it an awful lot. Took me a long, long time to accept. I mean, for years, literally, every time I looked in the mirror, I'd start virtually, if I looked in the mirror too long, I'd feel like I'd start welling up. You know, it was a terrible thing to kind of come to terms with. And, but you know, none of that really bothers me anymore. It took me a long time, but eventually, and it's a miraculous thing, but as the old saying, time is a great healer, and it really is. So with the passing of time, I truly learned to accept the new me and that new version. Yeah. And that was what enabled me to really get on in the world, you know.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Like I say, people will be watching thinking, fuck me, man. Like, it's an unbelievable story from what you've been through to what you're achieving now, climbing mountains, not quitting, doing inspirational talks, writing books. Like, I always say this shit, but as long as you've got air in your lungs, you've always got something to give, not matter your appearance, not matter how fucked up you are, no matter how old you are or what you've done in the past. Like, people can change, people can make changes, adapt to the situation, and then kick on and still create an amazing life. Like, life is just...
It's true, James. But what I will say on that is, no matter who the individual, no matter what the journey, no matter what the issues they face, if you want to get on in life, you've got to fundamentally want to help yourself. And you've got to be hungry for that kind of process to nurture your path. It doesn't just happen. You've got to want it. And that's the things that I learned in life. I think looking back at perhaps my military service, there was a reason that I was able to achieve and perhaps get to some of those parts or points in the service where I got to.
Do you still get any pain or anything, medication, stuff like that?
I'm not so much pain, no. Fortunately, things are pretty good in that department. But, I'm still, believe it or not, under a consultant now. So even after all these years, I'm under a laser doctor. So they're still doing a bit of work on the face and tweaking some of the scars.
Are you excited, though, for the future, that the new technology that's coming out, things? I think somebody's just got a fucking head transplant there and brain transplants and, like, the future. Like,
there's hope for me yet, then, head transplant.
But to, new things are coming out, because I've seen people getting, with skin, it's just attaching and everything's... Are you planning for the future? Do you look into stuff like that to see what's there for yourself?
Honest to God, I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, even a few years ago now, I was offered full ear reconstruction. But when I looked into it, I think it's a Japanese technique called Nagata, named after the Japanese surgeon that kind of pioneered this. But what they do is they actually cut into the rib cage, and they do something called, they scoop it out, the cartilage from the rib. It's called cookie cuttering, to scoop out that cartilage. They can then malleate it and sort of, because it's got a cartilage, is quite sort of malleable, they can then form it into an ear, and then basically, in terms of the plastic surgery, they can reconnect, and then you've got a more aesthetic ear. But when I asked the questions, okay, because my hearing's a bit dodgy from the where the aircraft piled in the distance and then exploded, and that blast damaged my ears somewhat, and I've got this permanent tinnitus. I said to the surgeon, is it going to help the pickup, you know, in the audio sense? Am I going to enhance my quality of hearing? And he said, no, not really. He said, it's only going to help, the aesthetics outwardly in terms of your appearance. And I'm like, I'm not that bothered then, honestly.
What about stem cells?
There was a lot of talk about stem cells, but I think, believe it or not, things are happening in the world of stem cell surgery. But I think they're a long way off, making sort of real practical gains with all of that at the moment. I think it's still very much in its infancy. But I do think that there's huge scope for that in the future, having looked at a few documentaries and even talked to a few surgeons over the years. And it's likely that, they're going to be able to possibly, grow complete organs for complete sort of stem cell organ transplant. So there's going to be probably no end to what they can do in the future. Who knows? But, I mean, listen, they've come a very long way. I mean, the reality is, my injury was 2007, so I was in hospital till 2009. And let's say that injury had happened even 10 years before. There's the likelihood would have been that perhaps in the acute phase of the intensive care, they may not have necessarily had the expertise to kind of keep me going and bring me back from that.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. So, that's why you've got to give a massive thanks and appreciation to the nurses, the doctors. What they do for individuals is unbelievable. Tremendous. Like, they don't get enough credit. They're the ones who should be getting footballers' wages. They're the ones who should be getting looked after the most. Like, my mum's a home help as well, and the stuff that they need to do and cleaning up shit and piss every day and night and helping people and just try to be there and comfort people. It's honestly unbelievable. That's why I always believe there's so much goodness in the world, because there is so much goodness and that people do, and it's a great thing to see that.
There's a lot of great work that goes on. There really is. And you've got to see that and not necessarily look at like look at, it's easy to look at the negatives in life and look at perhaps the darker side of life that I mentioned and focus on that, because we've got the media kind of propagating that kind of information regularly. But there is an awful lot of good that goes on in the world. And indeed, yeah, a lot of medical staff are doing tremendous work out there for so many people.
Yeah. Where do you go from here now, brother?
So from here, you know, there's bits and pieces going on. I'm still doing a bit of speaking work, and there's a bit of demand from that. And I'm still trying to gently sort of promote the book as well. And, you know, meeting people, good people like yourself doing these big podcasts. So there's a bit more of that that will go on. And then I'm kind of interested in possibly, you know, taking further steps, perhaps with the kind of corporate world, and perhaps, you know, utilising the story in the sort of corporate world a bit more, and perhaps, but maybe diversifying a little bit as well, and perhaps sidestepping with it as well. So maybe if there's a role that I could perhaps tap into, where I could perhaps help to connect the corporate world with the charity sectors a little bit more, and help with that, then that might be something that I'll look into.
Have you got a lot of people who go through a lot of trauma, maybe it's been burned, reaching out to you to speak and look for inspiration to then?
There's bits and pieces, yeah. So there's all kinds of weird and wonderful things that I do. So I've spoken to, all sorts of different audiences, from younger students in schools and sort of youth groups, like young farmers, like Women's Institute, to, you know, through to small businesses, right the way through to some of the bigger corporates, you know, for like their annual general meetings as sort of guest speaker and so on. So it's quite bizarre, you know, some of the stuff that I've been subject to, you know, doing some of the speaking work that I do to help others. Mm-hmm. I mean, just this week I had the privilege of being away and speaking to a team of serving police officers, which was quite interesting because they've come from all different forces around the country, and they were on like an interesting kind of adventurous kind of respite weekend, for want of a better description. And I was kindly invited along just to come and share the story about, you know, because obviously I had some service back in the day, and talk about the trauma that I'd been through and how I was able to kind of hold on and sort of nurture my own development and come through all of that. And I think that perhaps helped some of those guys and girls that I was talking to. So yeah, lots of different audiences, and it's an interesting journey. I mean, like if you'd have said to me, you know, 15 years ago, oh yeah, one day you're going to be, you know, you're going to be kind of out there talking, sharing your life experience and being a public speaker, I probably would have never have believed you. But it is, it's interesting how perhaps where one door closes, if you've got the ability to embrace a new life, as it were, then other doors will potentially open up.
Yeah, I think we've always got to...
And also put your best foot forward, you know?
I think we've always got to embrace new life, though. We've also got to embrace new circumstances. Like, doors always close, but you've got to be the person who fucking goes and opens other ones, because they ain't going to open themselves.
No.
You've got to kick those fuckers down and say, look, I'm here, no matter what you've went through, no matter the circumstances for myself or anybody watching or listening, you've got to go and make it work. Do you know what I mean? There'll be plenty of people as well, because...
Yeah.
Going through the same shit as yourself, went through that sort of trauma, that's just quit, gave up. I thought I had it bad because I had a few addictions.
I think people give up for far lesser reasons, perhaps. I mean, I don't want to necessarily compare and contrast.
No, it's a million percent, a million percent, no, yeah.
You know, people may face, you know, lesser hardships and give up, you know, and that is quite a tragedy when you think about it, because there's always a life to live, and there's always... you know, perhaps blue skies around the corner when you've had like abject rainfall and sort of foul weather. You know, remember, you know, the heavens will open up and you know, and the clouds will part and there'll be blue skies again. Life will get better.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to believe that. But I was going to say that it pays to sometimes have the courage of your convictions to, if you've got a little bit of ambition, even no matter how kind of small and how trivial that ambition might seem, if you've got the courage to perhaps put your best foot forward in life, you can surprise yourself and you can often pull things out of the bag and really get on in the world. I mean, I know people that have managed to pull themselves out of the gutter. You know, they've had perhaps drink problems or drug problems, for example. They've acknowledged that. They've got a bit of help and they've thought, oh, perhaps there's no opportunities for me because I've got a bit of a criminal record or whatever. But I've known such individuals that have then volunteered and they've got involved as a volunteer with various organisations. And by volunteering, sometimes they do a little bit of voluntary work, even, you know, half a day a week or a couple of sessions per week. And it's enough to meet people and connect and join the dots. And then through meeting other people, as the old saying, sometimes it's not what you know, it's who you know. Other people can help you then open some doors and create opportunities. And so I've known people that have gone from being in a pretty dark place through kind of putting their best foot forward, perhaps doing a bit of voluntary work, and then that leads to whatever. And then the next thing you know, they're in paid employment and they're really cracking on with life.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, some, so I know of a few examples, mm-hmm. you know, very positive.
Where can people get a hold of you, Jamie?
So, I mean, I'm contactable through social media. So I've got, you know, verified accounts and a page with both Facebook and Instagram. Facebook is just Jamie Hull, and Instagram is I am Jamie Hull 1. And then I've also got a website that I'm contactable through for mainly sort of the element of speaking work that I do. And that is simply jamiehull.co.uk.
For anybody watching that's maybe going through some trauma just now that think that they can't get through it, what advice would you give for them?
Simple advice. You know, fundamentally, to not lose hope completely. Because remember, I was virtually there. I was right on the borderline of being that guy that was losing all hope. You know, and I mentioned that in the sort of the testimony of what I went through. But, you know, from my own sort of humble experience, not to lose hope entirely, no matter how difficult or dark life can seemingly stoop, understand that, you know, there is light potentially around the corner. You've just got to kind of keep working and kind of keep kind of moving towards the, you know, those better days and hold on. And if you work towards your objectives and hold on, you can really surprise yourself. And the biggest thing that I learned was to believe in yourself and to understand that that ultimately through great will and determination, all of us can overcome life's obstacles. And that's what it's all about.
Love it, Jamie. Listen, brother, for coming on today and telling your story, it's been unbelievable. You're a true inspiration and so many people will get a lot from this. Can't wait to see what you do for the future, mate. I'm a massive fan, massive supporter, and I'll be keeping a close eye to what you do. But honestly, brother, unbelievable, and keep fighting a good fight.
Cheers, James.
God bless you, brother. You can also watch my podcast on my YouTube channel. The link is in the bio if you'd like to subscribe. You can follow me on my social media platforms to see who my next guest is. Follow me on Facebook at JamesEnglish11, Twitter, JamesEnglish0, Instagram, JamesEnglish2. You can also download these podcasts on iTunes or Spotify.